Okay, so you've been digging deep into Isaiah and you've got some really fascinating questions about the book itself.
Yeah.
Today we're going to kind of unpack those mysteries together, going beyond the surface to uncover who really wrote this prophetic masterpiece.
Sounds good.
Our source material excerpts from Dr. Marv Wilson's lecture series on the biblical prophets,
Okay.
specifically session 24 on Isaiah Part 2.
All right.
What's fascinating is we often think of these prophets as, larger than life figures, almost mythical.
Yeah.
But Isaiah was a real person who lived and breathed in ancient Jerusalem.
That's right. What's fascinating here is that we often think of these prophets as larger than life figures, almost mythical.
Right.
But Isaiah was a real person who lived and breathed in ancient Jerusalem.
All right, so let's start there.
Okay.
Paint me a picture of Isaiah the man. What was his life like?
Well, he wasn't just wandering the desert proclaiming doom and gloom. He was deeply embedded in Jerusalem society. He even inspected the city's water supply, probably with a worried eye on those pesky Syrians and their potential attacks.
Wow, so he was a city official as well as a prophet.
Exactly.
Never thought about it that way.
And get this, he was married. His wife is even referred to as a prophetess in the text. Plus, he wrote a biography of King Uzziah.
A biography. Now that's multi-talented. Okay, so we've got this picture of Isaiah as a real person living a pretty remarkable life, but there's this dark detail that always sticks with me, the story about his death.
Ah, yes, the tale of Isaiah being executed by being sawed in half inside a hollow tree trunk. It's a gruesome image, isn't it? Though we should clarify that this comes from Jewish tradition, not the Bible itself.
Right. It's like one of those extra biblical stories that adds a whole other layer of intrigue to his life. But speaking of intrigue, let's move on to the book itself. This wasn't just your average scroll, right?
Definitely not. Imagine a 24-foot scroll
Whoa.
containing all 66 chapters,
Wow.
originally without any verse or chapter divisions.
Hold on, 24 feet. I'm picturing trying to scroll through that thing to find a specific passage. Talk about a workout.
Right.
And it makes me wonder, how did they navigate this massive text?
That's a great question. And it leads us to something called Haftarah readings in synagogues.
Haftarah readings. All right, break that down for me. What are those all about?
Essentially, they're selections from the prophets that are thematically linked to the Torah portion read that day. It's like a conversation between the texts spanning centuries.
So you'd read a passage from the Torah, and then the Haftarah reading would be a section from a prophet like Isaiah that connects to that theme.
Precisely. And here's where it gets really interesting. Some scholars believe that this practice might have originated from Jews hiding their Torah study during times of persecution.
Wait, really? So instead of reading the Torah directly, they'd substitute a related passage from the prophets to avoid detection. That's like a secret code.
Exactly. They'd maintain their tradition and study even under pressure. And guess what? Isaiah is the most used prophet in Haftarah readings, which tells you something about his prominence throughout Jewish history.
It's incredible to think about this tradition potentially being born out of a need to preserve their faith. It really adds another layer of meaning to these texts. But okay, let's get to the heart of the mystery. Did one person really write the entire book of Isaiah?
The million-dollar question. Did Isaiah, son of Amoz, pen all 66 chapters, or are there multiple authors at play?
And this is where the whole Deutero-Isaiah theory comes in, right?
You got it. This theory proposes that a second author, often called Deutero-Isaiah, likely wrote chapters 40 through 66, potentially during the Babylonian exile, around 540 BC.
540 BC. That's over 200 years after Isaiah lived. This idea must have been revolutionary when it emerged in the late 1700s.
It absolutely shook things up. Imagine questioning the authorship of such a central text.
Right.
It'd be like saying Shakespeare didn't write all of his plays.
Yeah. Why? Okay, so let's unpack arguments for this Deutero-Isaiah theory. What evidence is there that points toward multiple authors?
Well, first, there's historical context. Chapters 40 through 66 seem to reflect the experience of the Babylonian exile with Jerusalem in ruins and the people living as captives.
Okay.
Remember, Isaiah himself lived before this happened.
That makes sense. You'd expect someone living through that devastation to have a different perspective than someone writing before it occurred. But is that enough to conclude there was a second author?
It's one piece of the puzzle. There's also the issue of literary style. The language and tone shift noticeably in those later chapters. They become more emotional, poetic, and focused on comfort and hope.
That's interesting. The earlier chapters with their warnings and judgments do have a different feel. But couldn't a single author change their style depending on the message they're trying to convey?
That's a good point. It's certainly possible. But some scholars argue that the shift is so drastic, it points toward different personalities and perspectives behind the text.
So we've got the historical setting and the stylistic differences. Anything else that suggests multiple authors might be at work here?
There are also some significant theological shifts. The earlier chapters emphasize a coming messianic king, while the later chapters introduce this concept of a suffering servant who brings redemption through suffering.
Okay, that does seem like a pretty major distinction. It makes me think about how different groups within Judaism might have interpreted the role of the Messiah differently.
Exactly. And then there's the Cyrus conundrum.
Okay.
Chapters 44 and 45 explicitly mention Cyrus the Persian king who freed the Jews from Babylon in 539 BC.
Wait, so the book mentions a king who hadn't even been born when Isaiah was alive. Wouldn't that be a pretty strong case for a later author?
It's a compelling argument. How could Isaiah have known about Cyrus centuries in advance? This is where things get really intriguing. Could it be a later addition to the text?
Right.
A clue pointing towards another author? We'll delve into those possibilities in part two.
All right, so last time we left off with that Cyrus cliffhanger, how could Isaiah mention a king who lived centuries after him? It definitely seems like a point in favor of another author.
It's a compelling piece of the puzzle, isn't it? But before we jump to conclusions, we need to explore the other side of the debate, the arguments for the unity of Isaiah for a single author.
Okay, so if we're sticking with Isaiah as the sole author, how do we explain these seemingly conflicting details? Like the mention of Cyrus, the different writing styles, the historical discrepancies, it seems like a tough case to make.
It does, but there are some intriguing counterarguments. One key point is that Isaiah might have been writing prophetically about a future event, the exile and the rise of Cyrus.
So like a prediction, he saw all coming centuries in advance. That's some serious foresight.
Exactly. Prophets often spoke about events far beyond their immediate time frame. It's a core element of prophetic literature. Think of it like those time jump episodes in our favorite TV shows, a glimpse into a future that's yet to unfold.
Okay, I can see that. But what about the stylistic differences between the first and second parts of the book? The tone and language shift pretty dramatically. Can we really attribute that to a single author?
It's a valid question, but consider this, even a brilliant writer like Isaiah could have different writing styles depending on the subject matter and the intended audience.
So maybe he used a more poetic, comforting tone when addressing a community in exile, as opposed to the direct warnings he gave to the people of Jerusalem before the exile.
Precisely. It's like a musician using different instruments or genres to express different emotions. A somber piano piece for a moment of reflection, a driving rock anthem for a call to action. The artist is the same, but the approach shifts to suit the purpose.
I like that analogy. It makes sense. But okay, let's go back to Cyrus. Even if we accept the idea of prophecy, how could Isaiah have known his name? How could he have included that specific detail centuries before Cyrus was even born?
Ah, the Cyrus conundrum strikes again. This is where the role of scribes and the transmission of texts gets really interesting.
Okay, tell me more. What do scribes have to do with this whole debate?
Well, remember, in ancient times, scribes weren't just copyists. They were also editors and interpreters. They played a crucial role in preserving and transmitting texts, often over long periods.
So they weren't just passively copying words. They were actively engaged with the material, adding their own understanding and interpretations.
Exactly. And some scholars suggest that Isaiah, as a prominent prophet, might have had a school of disciples or scribes who continued his work after his death.
Like carrying on his legacy and teaching. So maybe they added or clarified certain passages under Isaiah's authority even after he was gone. That would explain how a name like Cyrus could appear in the text.
Precisely. In this view, the unity of Isaiah isn't solely about a single person putting pen to paper, but rather a continuous tradition of teaching and interpretation within Isaiah's school.
That really changes the way we think about authorship. It becomes less about a single isolated genius and more about a community of scholars working together to preserve and transmit a message. So to recap, we have these two main camps. One believes in a second author, Deutero-Isaiah, who wrote during the exile. The other sees the book as a unified whole, potentially with later additions or clarifications from Isaiah's followers.
And it's important to remember that both sides have valid points. Scholars are still debating this, which shows just how complex and multi-layered these ancient texts are.
It definitely makes you realize that there isn't always a simple answer. Okay, so after hearing both sides, where do you land on this debate? What resonates most with you?
Personally, I'm fascinated by the idea of Isaiah's school and the collaborative nature of ancient authorship. It challenges our modern notion of a single isolated author and highlights the community aspect of textual transmission.
That's a great point. It reminds us that the Bible wasn't just dropped out of the sky fully formed. It was shaped and passed down through generations of faithful people, each adding their own layer of understanding.
Exactly. And regardless of whether you believe in a single author or multiple authors, the power and beauty of Isaiah's message shine through. His words have resonated for centuries, offering comfort, hope, and challenge to countless people.
Absolutely. Whether it's the warnings, the promises, or the poetry, Isaiah's words have this timeless quality. But this brings us to a really crucial question. If the book of Isaiah potentially evolved over time, with additions and interpretations from later scribes, What does that tell us about how we approach the Bible today?
That's a question that takes us beyond Aiea and into the heart of how we understand and interpret Scripture as a whole. It challenges us to think critically about inspiration, interpretation, and the role of tradition.
That feels like a perfect segue into part three. We've gone from ancient water systems to prophetic time jumps to scribal schools, and now we're diving into even deeper waters.
Get ready, because this is when things get really interesting. We're going to wrestle with some big questions about how we engage with the Bible in a meaningful and relevant way.
Okay, so we've journeyed through ancient Jerusalem, explored prophetic pronouncements, even peeked into the world of ancient scribes. Now we're facing this question that goes way beyond Isaiah. If this book, and perhaps others, evolved over time, how does that change the way we approach the Bible today?
That's the heart of it, isn't it? This whole exploration into Isaiah's authorship isn't just some academic exercise. It raises profound questions about how we understand inspiration, interpretation, and tradition when it comes to Scripture.
All right, let's tackle those one by one. First up, inspiration. If there were multiple authors or later editions, Buck arrives, does that mean the Bible isn't inspired by God? That's a question that's probably on a lot of people's minds.
It's a natural concern, for sure. But the key here is remembering that inspiration doesn't necessarily equal dictation. God's inspiration works through human authors with their individual styles, personalities, and historical contexts.
So it's not about God, like, erasing the human element, but rather working through it. I'm picturing those nature documentaries where a vine grows around a rock, incorporating it into its form. The rock is still there, but it becomes part of something new and beautiful.
That's a beautiful image. It captures the idea perfectly. Think about how an artist uses their unique skills and personality to create a masterpiece. The artwork reflects both the artist's vision and the tools and techniques they used.
So in a way, God is the ultimate artist inspiring the human authors to create this incredible tapestry of Scripture.
Exactly. And that brings us to interpretation. Just like appreciating a work of art requires understanding the artist's context, interpreting the Bible means considering the historical and cultural backdrop of the text.
So we can't just read Isaiah or any part of the Bible with our 21st century mindset and expect to fully grasp what it meant to the original audience.
Right. We need to put ourselves in the sandals, so to speak, of the people who first heard these words. What were their concerns, their cultural norms? What was God conveying through the author in that specific historical moment?
It's like trying to understand a letter written centuries ago. You need to know the background, the relationships, even the slang of the time, to fully grab the nuances. It makes you realize how much deeper the Bible becomes when you take the time to understand its context.
Absolutely. It's about moving beyond a surface reading to uncover the richness and depth of the text. And this is where tradition comes into play. Throughout history, communities of faith have wrestled with these same scriptures, developing interpretations and traditions that have shaped their beliefs and practices.
So we're not just reading the Bible in isolation. We're part of this long line of believers who have been grappling with these texts for centuries. It's like joining a conversation that's been going on for millennia.
Precisely. And while we should always test those traditions against the scriptures themselves, we can learn a lot from those who came before us. They offer valuable insights and perspectives that can enrich our own understanding.
It's like having a guide in a vast library. They can point you to the most important books, the hidden gems you might have missed on your own. But ultimately, it's up to each of us to engage with the text, to wrestle with its meaning, and to seek God's guidance in applying it to our lives.
That's the beauty of it. The Bible is a living text that continues to speak to us in new and profound ways, even after centuries of study and interpretation.
So bringing it back to Isaiah, whether he wrote the entire books or had help from later scribes, his message still packs a punch. It's a message that resonates across time and cultures.
Absolutely. His words offer comfort to those facing exile, challenge us to live righteously, and point us towards a future filled with hope and restoration themes that are just as relevant today as they were back then.
And I think what we've learned in this deep dive is that the very questions surrounding the book's authorship actually invite us to engage with Scripture more deeply, to consider different perspectives, to appreciate the richness of the biblical tradition, and ultimately to find our own place in that ongoing conversation.
Beautifully said. It's about embracing the complexity and the mystery, knowing that the more we delve into these ancient texts, the more we discover about ourselves, our faith, and the God who speaks through it all.
This has been quite the journey. We've covered a lot of ground, from ancient water systems to prophetic timelines to scribal schools, and we've wrestled with some BIG questions about how we understand and interpret the Bible.
And hopefully this deep dive has equipped you to approach Isaiah, and indeed all of Scripture, with a renewed sense of curiosity, humility, and wonder.
Until next time, keep those scrolls unrolling and keep diving deep.